ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Thanks for listening and being part of my podcast. I hope 2024 is kind to you. In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts, with a mixture of interesting and thought-provoking guests discussing the human side and impact of crime on all those involved, including the investigators. And I'd love for you to give me a review if you can. They're just a great help to me. I give my guests the opportunity to tell their story in their own words and how they remember an incident. It may not be how others remember it, which I ask you to please keep in mind. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, contact Lifeline or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Thank you.
For a good story, we need that good-bad dichotomy, and it's easier to build that sympathy for someone who fits into the ideal victim category.
This week is the final part of my interview with Dr. Leah Williams. 2 weeks ago now, I introduced you to her. I said how I'd come across an article in The Guardian by Donna Liu, published in May 2023, titled, quote, "Kathleen Folbig, Science Sheds New Light on Case of Mother Convicted of Murdering Her Children," unquote. And the article caught my eye, as did an opinion in that article by Dr. Williams, where she stated, quote, "There's an entrenched traditional notion of what femininity is that I think can disadvantage women who come into contact with the criminal justice process. It's something that you really saw with the Lindy Chamberlain case. She didn't cry enough. She didn't seem sad enough. All the judgments made about character then feed into perceptions of criminal guilt," unquote. She says Kathleen Folbig was similarly demonised. Dr. Leah Williams, she's a lecturer in the School of Law, Society and Criminology in the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales. She teaches criminal law courses across the law and criminology programs and has an interest in legal education, criminalisation and the representation of crime and criminal justice processes in the media. Her doctoral research examined the ways in which gender norms are reinforced and amplified through the reporting of criminal trials and the relationship between those gender norms and notions of deviance. Her research is inspired by a fascination with the way in which criminal law and criminal justice processes are communicated to and understood by the public and the differences in social and legal definitions of justice. So, as I said, this is our final week of our interview with Dr. Williams, and we discuss a fair bit, would you believe, about our podcasts, the positives and negatives. But also, it's a really interesting discussion about social media. and how the justice system manages it or doesn't, and a juror's temptation to do some of their own research because social media is just so accessible. We discuss what in the media world is the ideal victim, the ideal offender, and what happens when somebody doesn't fit that description. And boy, are we treated to some fascinating insights about Dr. Williams' thoughts about New South Wales former policeman come murderer, Roger Rogerson, as his case was one of those case studies that she did in her PhD research, and how the media were restricted in how they could describe him during his trials. For instance, they weren't allowed to use the word disgraced or notorious because of the possible prejudice that that may cause. She also has some fairly, yeah, very, well, I think everything she says is interesting, but also about the O.J. Simpson trial and that car chase. How could you ever forget it? Anyway, have a great week. Enjoy your last week with Dr. Williams, and we'll talk next week. See you later. Podcasts have the ability to bring emotion into a discussion and engage the listener, which no newspaper or social media platform can. However, with that emotion comes the danger, I suppose, the ability to be able to sway a listener's viewpoint, because we as podcasters, we aren't confined by the rules of evidence, and that's actually can be quite dangerous. I think the Teacher's Pet podcast host, Hedley Thomas, he was very, very good at believing him, I suppose. His voice is soft, I don't know, let's say comforting. What are your thoughts on not so much Hedley Thomas? I suppose it's just the influence that emotion can bring to a discussion like on a podcast.
Podcasts are just so much more engaging than reading a media report or even watching a media report on the news, because a podcast, one, it's generally longer, so the amount of content is greater. Yeah. But you develop a kind of relationship with the podcast host or with the regular people who appear in the podcast, and it builds in you that level of trust. It builds in you that interest and that engagement and that investment in the case. And we saw that in the Teacher's Pet podcast, but you see it in there's a whole range of podcasts like that now, and you know, the first big one was Serial. You saw that engagement that people had, and for something like Serial, there was an accompanying website where all of the evidence or all of the sources that the hosts were talking about, that was all posted. You could go up and read it yourself. You could write to the host and say, oh, I know a person, or I found another thing, or, you know, you can actually actively engage with it in a way that you wouldn't necessarily. If you were reading in the newspaper about a particular case, you might not be moved to interact with that case in the way that you would in a podcast. You might never email, for example, the journalist and say, oh, hey, I might know a person. It's just a different form of relationship that you have as a member of a podcast audience. And I don't know whether that's because you tend to listen to podcasts on your own. You know, you tend to have it in your ears while you're walking or driving or doing chores or whatever it is that you might be doing. But also, as you say, podcast hosts, one of their key skills is to make you kind of feel like you're friends with them, to build that parasocial relationship and to invite you into a world. And I think that's what some of these podcasts do really effectively, which helps the public to engage more with the story and more with the issues that they're raising, which, as I mentioned, for the Teacher's Pet podcast, can be really good, because we may never have seen Chris Dawson be brought to justice without the Teacher's Pet, but can also potentially mean that narrative that's being put through the podcast, because it doesn't have to comply with the rules of evidence, is a different narrative than the narrative that is able to be told at trial. And that can, again, create that expectation gap between what happens in the legal process and what the public expects of the legal process.
Like my view is with Hedley Thomas, the host of the Teacher's Pet, my view is he's got such a gentle sort of nature, almost like, you know, a dad. He's just got a loving sort of a man. And I think to myself, I'd believe anything he said, you know, and I think that's why it the emotion in a podcast can be very, very powerful.
I was going to say that takes us back to that discussion of demeanour that we were having earlier. You know, we base our judgments on somebody's reliability or credibility, their guilt or innocence, on their demeanour, and that can be problematic.
Very. And, you know, I tend to agree with you, I think most people would, that I think Chris Dawson probably would never have faced court but for the podcast. So I think that's, you know, a huge positive for podcasts. I suppose I want to ask you that, just with social media again, just by asking jurors not to access any information on social media or otherwise, it puts a lot of trust in the juror, doesn't it? And I'm just wondering, how can the judicial system manage this better? Because it's getting too easy, in my view, for a juror just to have a quick look on their phone. Or, I mean, I know they're not supposed to, but human nature is you get a bit inquisitive, you want to have a bit of a look, no matter what somebody tells you. And, so do you have any ideas on how we can make this fairer, I suppose, for the defendant, because generally it's at the defendant's at his – what's the word, or his or her, I can't think of
their
the
right expense,
word.
Maybe.
Yeah, at their expense. Yeah, thank you. Yep.
I mean, it could be the defendant. It could also be if it's, again, I go back to sexual assault cases because that's where the victims tend to be under the most scrutiny, but it could be any complaint of any
crime.
You're
right.
But it could be that too. You know, the juror could Google the complainant and look at their photos online and make judgments about their demeanor. Yep. It comes down to trust. Primarily, I think, with the jury. So we have a number of studies that tell us that when, and most of these studies are done on mock jurors because it's very hard to get approval to study actual jurors, and there's a whole range of offences about soliciting jurors to give information about their time as a jury, and that's to protect jurors and make sure they're not, you know, harassed and harangued about any decisions that they make. It's about trust. So we trust that when jurors are brought into the courtroom, are impaneled and have the opening spiel given to them by the judge, which involves, you know, you are here to make a decision about whether the prosecution has proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt. You should make that evidence based only on, you should make that decision based only on the evidence presented in this courtroom. You should not do external research. You should, you know, rely on your own understanding of the evidence and your own evaluation of the strength of that evidence rather than evidence presented in media reports or extrinsic evidence, whatever it might be. We trust that the jurors take that on. And what we see from mock juror studies is that most jurors take the role of being on a jury quite seriously. They see it as a civic responsibility. They see it, and some people are actually overwhelmed by the responsibility of being on a jury. So, and that is also potentially one of the things that can lead to jurors engaging in misconduct, is that responsibility they feel for making the right decision. I have a colleague, Professor Jill Hunter, who's written a bit about juror sleuthing, which is where jurors go off and do their own investigations. And it's generally done well-meaningly. You know, it's generally done because they want to make sure they're making the right decision. And maybe they think there's a bit of a gap in the evidence, or maybe they want to double check whether what someone has said is true or whatever it might be. But the danger in doing that is that we don't have the ability to have that evidence tested. We don't have someone who can come in and say, well, yes, you might have gone to that location to check what the lighting was like, but this offence occurred 5 years ago. How are we to know that that lighting was the same, or that the moon was in the same place, or that tree hadn't been trimmed, or, you know, whatever it is? So it goes back to trust. We trust that jurors will do the right thing because they understand the sort of enormity of the role that they are taking on. And we also trust that if there is a juror who does misbehave, that one of the other jurors will tell on them. What we tend to see from juror studies is jurors understand that what they see in court and what they might read in the media can be different, and they're encouraged to trust themselves. They're encouraged to understand that they are the experts when it comes to this particular trial, because they're the ones who are sitting there and watching every minute of the evidence, whereas a journalist might not be, or a member of the public might not be. They are someone who is the authority on whether they think that that evidence proves the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And so they're encouraged not to go home and workshop it with their loved ones, not to put it up on social media and ask their followers what their followers think. In some instances, it's easier to find out if a juror has engaged in that kind of misconduct. You know, we've had situations in the past where we've had jurors who, you know, maybe have been tweeting about the trial, which is obviously not allowed. We've had jurors who have tried to send friend requests either to the accused or sometimes to the judge or the lawyers in the case during the trial. Also, definitely not allowed.
Tell me you're not serious.
I am 100% serious. And the problem with that is, you know, there's an apprehension of a conflict of interest, right? You know, when you're impaneled on a jury, you've read the list of potential witnesses, and you're supposed to excuse yourself if you know of any of those people, so that we avoid that apprehension of a conflict of interest. But so, you know, there's always rogue jurors. There's always people who maybe don't necessarily fully comprehend why those rules are in place. But generally, we trust that jurors understand the role that they're playing. They understand that they're the ones who are best placed to make the decision that they are making. And we hope and trust that if a juror does go rogue, one of the other jurors will bring it to the attention of the judge. There's not a lot more we really can do, because we can't go back to seconding jurors. You know, we don't want to deprive jurors of their liberty while they're engaging in this civic service. But also, you know, seconding jurors isn't necessarily going to solve the issue of social media either. We can't take people's phones off them. We can't put them in some kind of media blackout. So we have to trust that it's enough that we explain to them the role that they are playing, the importance of that role, and the why behind why they're asked not to do their own research or engage with media content about the trial.
Can we talk a little bit, we are heading towards the close, but can we talk a little bit about the fine line between entertainment versus education with podcasts? You've said, quote, and I can't remember where I read this, if Lynette Dawson hadn't been white, if she hadn't been young, if she hadn't been wealthier, would there have been the same interest in the teacher's pet? What if it had been a First Nations person or a gay relationship? Would we have seen this level of public investment? Can you expand on that a bit for us?
What we see in media reporting about crime events generally is a real skewing towards reporting on matters that involve what we would term an ideal victim. So the ideal victim, it's a concept introduced by a prominent criminologist, Nils Christie, and it's essentially someone who is irrefutably not responsible for what happened to them. Mm-hmm. So the ideal victim tends to be white. They tend to be sort of younger, but not so young that we might worry that they're engaged in something that they shouldn't be. They tend to be someone who is not engaged in any way in anything that could be understood to be nefarious. So they're not someone who was out drunk. They're not someone who was maybe engaging in taking recreational drugs before they were assaulted or whatever it might be. They were not someone who in any way could have been seen to precipitate the offence that was committed against them. And the reason we see this skewing of reporting towards ideal victims is because it's easier to build a kind of good-bad dichotomy of this poor victim and this horrible person who's committed this crime against them. And that's because the media needs to communicate whatever story it is they're communicating in a pretty succinct way. They need to be able to draw on existing narratives or existing tropes that people are familiar with in order to sort of fill in the story. And it makes for a story with an ideal victim allows us to skim over some of the nuance that is involved in criminal matters. So a lot of people who are criminally victimized are also people who maybe don't have necessarily clean slates. They might be people who were drunk. They might be people who were engaged in taking drugs. There might be people who themselves have a history of assault offenses or whatever it might be. So for a good story, we need that good-bad dichotomy, and it's easier to build that sympathy for someone who fits into the ideal victim category. It is harder to do that for people who experience marginalization because of their race or because of their class. It's harder for those people to be understood as ideal victims, even if they objectively have done nothing to precipitate the offending against them, but simply because of their race, because of where they live, because of their class, the color of their skin, their religion, whatever it might be. There's just a lack of perception that that person is as sympathetic as a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, middle-class white woman. And I think this is something that podcasts can be really useful for, despite the fact that, you know, we've been talking about Teacher's Pet and that's about Lynette Dawson. But if we think about the Bowerville podcast, that was a podcast aimed at trying to raise awareness of crimes committed against First Nations people in the New South Wales town of Bowerville.
Yep.
That ability for podcasts to maybe step away a little bit from the constraints that we see in mainstream media, where we do really see this heavy reliance on good, bad, you know, ideal victim versus offender. We see that a little bit more now with the greater range of media that we have than perhaps we used to. But I think it's still something that is quite prevalent and means that there is potentially less access to justice for people who, you know, maybe aren't as wealthy or who aren't white or who, you know, don't have the kind of social privilege or social capital that somebody like Lynette Dawson had.
You know, I know we don't live in an ideal world, but an ideal world to me, and of course to most people listening, everybody should have the same access to the same amount of money, the same good lawyers, the same good defence counsels as anybody else, no matter their race, their beliefs, the colour of their skin. But unfortunately, that's not right. To me, the law, it's not fair, because somebody who can't afford a good lawyer may actually be found guilty because, just by the person that's representing them. I don't think it's fair in any way, shape or form.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
To me, it's all about the money you have, and that really gets under my skin, because there's not many of us that have the sort of money that, you know, like a decent lawyer probably costs, I don't know, $5,000 or $6,000 a day. Who's got that? Oh, well, I don't know many people. I don't know many people that have got that sort of money, and I just don't think that's fair.
It's extraordinarily expensive to defend yourself against criminal charges. So typically, if you're going to trial and you want to have a barrister, so a barrister is essentially an advocate. They're the ones who stand up and do most of your arguing in court. But if to have a barrister, you also need to have a solicitor who briefs out to that barrister. A barrister can cost you $10,000 a day. So if a typical trial runs for 2 weeks, then that's $100,000 just on the barrister, let alone what you're paying to the solicitor and all of the other costs that relate to. You know, it's an extraordinarily expensive process. And it's, you know, like you said, most people can't afford that. But even people with excellent lawyers can end up being convicted. So Kathleen Folbig, she had excellent lawyers, really well-respected defense counsel. They were public defenders, but public defenders, you know, are generally very excellent. And she was still convicted because of, not because of, but in part we can see the narrative that was put forward by the prosecution really drew on those expectations of motherhood, really drew on those expectations of femininity, and used her diaries, you know, things that she'd written in her diaries that we now in the judicial inquiries have seen evidence from experts that say this is what we would expect of a woman who has lost her babies. You know, someone who has had infants die before might write things in her diary like, why does this keep happening to me, or what have I done, or, you know, blaming yourself for the death of your babies is a natural response. It's not an admission of guilt. Having those words put to the jurors as admissions, essentially, you know, from what we can infer, because we don't know what what the jury based the decision on, but we can infer that that was an effective strategy in leading to her conviction. And, you know, as I said, she, Kathleen Folbig, had excellent lawyers, and they went over to overcome those kind of narratives and those tropes. So yes, money is important. And if you have money, you may have a more skilled barrister, or you may have the capacity to pursue appeals more readily than somebody who doesn't have that money. But, you know, money is not everything when you're also fighting against those kind of social expectations and those pressures that can influence the way that people make decisions about you.
I can you're making me feel old now, because I can remember when I was a policewoman, there was a certain defence lawyer for if ever you were wanted to get off an 05, like a drink driving offence, you employed him, not me, but I'm just saying it was renowned. It was renowned that he would probably get you off, and he was $5,000 a day, and that would have been in, I don't know, let's say the 1990s, so or the early 2000s. So you're right, I'm probably a bit behind the times, but it's still a lot of money, isn't it? And it's a money that most, oh, I don't know, most people don't have. Hey, I also think another thing, I know we're talking a lot about the teacher's pet, but what I also think it's done is that it's helped, I think, and given the public confidence that, and to for them to understand that no matter how long ago an offence occurred, there are a lot of times avenues available to report something or even seek advice. You know, whether it what was that? That was 30 years ago or something. It was a long time ago anyway. So I think as we're talking, there are a lot of positives with podcasts. I suppose just finishing off, you have, I would imagine you've got some thoughts on the media coverage of number one, O.J. Simpson, and number two, Roger Rogerson. Can we close with a couple of your, take us through that a little bit and your thoughts?
Absolutely. So I agree with you, just to go back to what you were saying about podcasts and increasing trust in the public that, you know, the system can come into action decades after a crime. I actually think that's a really useful thing because you know, we always hear of cold cases, and generally the longer ago a crime is, the harder it is to prove because witnesses die, memories fade, evidence is destroyed or lost or whatever. It can be harder, but it's not impossible. And I think it's, as you say, useful for people's trust in the system to know that and to know that in such a high profile way. On O.J. Simpson and Roger Rogerson. So Roger Rogerson was actually one of the case studies in my PhD research. So I'm very familiar with his case and was really interested in the recent coverage of his death. O.J. Simpson, this is a case that I think sits in a really interesting place, not only for the time at which it occurred, but also the fact that it occurred in the US. So let's start with that and then we'll come back to Rogerson. The O.J. Simpson trial occurred sort of right around the start of the 24-hour news cycle, which took off a bit in the US a bit earlier here than took off a little bit earlier in the US than it did here. But also there are different rules in the US about what can be reported and how it can be reported. The First Amendment means that restrictions on what can be reported are really limited, if not non-existent, in the US. So the way that that case was reported is kind of extraordinary to Australian eyes because it's so different to how we're allowed to report on criminal matters here. And judgments can be made about whether inviting the public to see the whole show is a good thing or whether it does create this sense of criminal trials as a form of entertainment. You know, do we watch court TV to, you know, entertain ourselves? And does it create lawyers who are maybe a little bit too aware of the fact that they're being watched and so they put on a bit of a show? And I'm not saying that there are lawyers who do that, but it's, you know, one of the arguments against televising proceedings in Australia is, you know, what impact is it going to have on the way that the trials run? So the O.J. Simpson trial was extraordinary, even in the 1990s, with the level of coverage. And it was really one of the first big cases like that. Now we see that kind of coverage, even of civil cases in the US. You can think about the Johnny Depp Amber Heard case and how that was streamed. And there was so much coverage of that and so much kind of public engagement with that and public statements of who people believed, you know, were you on Team Johnny or Team Amber? And, I think it's problematic to have that kind of live constant commentary on what people think about a court case as it's going because most people aren't watching the whole thing. Most people don't have the full context and it's potentially very prejudicial to have people who have watched, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes, half an hour of a case making really bold statements about what they believe and who they believe. And that's something that can possibly influence a decision maker. In Australia, because we don't have the right to free speech in the way that the US does, because we have, I suppose, a judiciary that's a bit more conservative about what can be reported, and because we have those sub judice restrictions and contempt laws that apply to those, the way in which matters are reported in Australia is much different. And even though we can make statements about, oh, you know, the coverage of crime is sensational and, you know, the tabloidization of crime news and that kind of thing, really what we see in relation to criminal proceedings is pretty sedate compared to reporting on crime events generally before they enter that sub judice period and compared to the way that we see reporting in other jurisdictions. So on the Roger Rogerson trial, the difficulty that the media had for this trial was that Rogerson was notorious, but they couldn't say he was notorious because that would be prejudicial. And that was actually one of the reasons why the trial of the trial that actually ended up going ahead of Roger Rogerson and Glenn McNamara wasn't the first attempt at that trial. That trial had been discontinued previously because there had been what were deemed to be prejudicial remarks made by McNamara's counsel that raised Rogerson's kind of past in a way that, you know, encouraged the jury to go and explore his past a little bit more. So the media coverage really relied on the fact that people would recognize his name, and it, you know, is quite a recognizable name. If you were someone who was in New South Wales in the 80s and the 90s, you would be familiar with him, and it would maybe jog your memory about what he had been involved in, what he'd been accused of, might jog your memory of the Richard Roxburgh Blue murder, which, you know, was released in the mid-1990s, I think, and pretty popular. But the way that that trial was covered was essentially highlighting the fact that he was a former police officer, so they could say he was a former police officer.
Yep.
Often it was said that Roger Rogerson joked that he should change his name by DPOL to disgraced former police officer Roger Rogerson. They left out the disgraced during the criminal trial generally because that would be seen to be prejudicial.
Yes, yeah.
But what I found in looking at the reporting on this case was they were still able to frame Rogerson and McNamara to an extent, but we'll talk about Rogerson. They were able to frame Rogerson as deviant, as socially deviant before his guilt, his legal guilt was confirmed, by comparing him to what we might consider to be the ideal police officer. So they mentioned that he was a former police officer or a former detective. Almost all of the articles written about the trial note former police officer. And then there were these kind of implicit comparisons made with the police who had engaged in the investigation and who were giving evidence, and the way that the police had essentially put the case together and found him, and the kind of incompetent way that Rogerson had committed the offence. You know, almost the entire thing was captured on CCTV. The fact that, you know, he and McNamara were really not very good at covering their tracks, that it was such a kind of poorly executed crime, ultimately, was held up to be like, look, you know, not only does he not live up to the expectation, this kind of social expectation that we have of police officers as being law-abiding citizens and people who are supposed to keep the community safe and uphold law and order. And, you know, again, there are people who may disagree with that characterization of police. We know that not all police are necessarily living up to that ideal, but in the same way that we have the feminine ideal, we have this police officer ideal. I know you're a former police officer. I don't want to.
No. I was just going to say, I think generally the perception of police is that they're good law-abiding citizens in every, and I'm not sticking up for police. I'm just saying I think most of us in the community are good law-abiding people. You're going to get rogues, aren't you, in every career. But, I completely, you know, there are some, I have worked. I can tell you now, I have worked with some very, very suspect, untruthful, dishonest policemen, which I'm ashamed to say. But, you know, it's...
You come across them in every aspect of life.
You do. Feel free to say whatever you want. I'm going to get you to give evidence. I'm going to put a note out there. Dr. Leah Williams, if anybody wants any expert evidence, she's your woman. No, go on. Sorry, Leah.
You should never
have told me that.
in the same way that women who come into contact with the criminal justice system are held up to this feminine ideal, what I found is that for men, we don't really have a masculine ideal. There's no one clear idea of what a good man is. There are some commonalities, you know, generally they're strong, they're successful, they're competent, they're, you know, whatever. But there are different types of acceptable masculinities in a way that there are not different kinds of acceptable femininities generally. So for men, it's harder to see them as departing from that ideal masculinity, because also ideal masculinity can involve aggression or can involve some of the traits that are associated with criminality too. Mm. So for men, what my research found is that it was more holding them against the ideal of role they played in society. And for Rogerson, the role that he was compared against was the role of police officer. So there was this ideal version of a police officer against which he was compared, and he was shown to be not only a bad person, but a bad police officer. And that's what his deviance was based on. That's what was used to amplify his deviance, to show that he was the kind of person who was the most incontestably deviant person in the story before the legal verdict of his guilt was entered. As I said, the media is pretty limited in what they can say about his past during the trial. So they couldn't even give hints. You know, they couldn't use those terms, notorious or disgraced, or most of the time they didn't have those. But there was that real, if you read the reports carefully, there is that comparison in there about, whether he lives up to this expectation of what we expect a police officer to live up to. And then once the verdict is in, to an extent, those restrictions loosen, and then we saw quite a bit of reporting about his past. We saw allegations of him being involved in other murders, all of these kind of things, which in a way is a kind of catharsis maybe for the media, saying, here's all the stuff we couldn't tell you during the trial, but this all confirms that him being found guilty was the right decision, because look what a horrible person he is.
Oh, yeah. What was it about Roger Rogerson that made you want to do him as a case study?
Partly it was good timing. So his case happened to be on while I was doing my PhD. And partly it was the fact that it was a really interesting case. So one, it was a murder case. So murder cases are relatively rare in New South Wales, that we hear about them a lot, but in terms of their actual prevalence, they're relatively rare. But my PhD required me to look at high profile cases, because I needed cases that were going to be widely reported. And there was a celebrity aspect to it, in the sense that a former disgraced New South Wales police detective can be a celebrity. There's a celebrity aspect to it. There was a kind of, it was a trial of co-accused, and they were using what's called cutthroat defences. So they were both, Rogerson and McNamara were pointing the finger at each other, saying, it wasn't me, it was him. So that added a level of interest to it. But it was also just, a trial that was going to attract, you know, you could see, if you look at the literature about what amounts to a high-profile trial, this one ticked all of the boxes.
And all of them, I imagine, yeah?
Pretty well all of them. Yeah. It didn't have an ideal victim because Jamie Gow, the victim of Rogerson and McNamara, had been allegedly involved in drug supply.
Yes.
That's why he was killed. So it didn't have everything that a high profile, that the literature tells us a high profile trial should have, but it had enough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it still does. I still read it and think, how did that man ever fall from grace? Like, he was, you know, apparently a fantastic detective that could talk to anyone and have anyone sort of almost confess to him. And then, boy, talk about a fall from grace. Now, Leah, I get the feeling that we could talk forever, but at some point we have to call it quits. look, thank you for just your important research and for educating the public and bringing attention to those issues surrounding coverage of true crime, particularly through podcasts, which is obviously my interest. But your work is so important. And look, the public do have a right to a certain point. Well, not to a certain point. I think the public have a right in knowing about miscarriages of justice and other aspects of our justice system. But sometimes it is to the detriment of the witness, the victim, or the suspect or offender. I suppose we need to get that balance right, don't we? Because if we don't, there is going to be innocent people who end up in jail or guilty people who, due to not being provided procedural fairness, they never have to face a court. So your work is really important. Please, I'd love to have you back sometime. There's so much we could talk about, which is clear.
Yes.
But thank you again, and thanks for participating and just, you know, taking us into another world that so many of us, you know, I don't think we think about enough. So thanks. Oh,
thank you so much for having me and for letting me sort of go on and on about something that I'm so interested in and so passionate about, and that my students often, you know, don't give me the level of engagement that I would love to see from them. They don't necessarily match my passion. So thank you so much for having me on for this conversation. It's been really enjoyable. And as you say, it's a really important conversation to have, because that question about what is justice and what it means for justice to be achieved is such a difficult one and such a complex one, and there's so many moving parts.
I think today has shown how complex it is. It's not straightforward. There's lots of, you know, all different ways it can go. But I understand we're all doing our best, even, you know, and the judges, the criminal process system, the judicial process, we're doing the best we can, but we need to get better and we need to learn from our mistakes. So,
And humans are imperfect. Humans are the ones who run the criminal justice system. So the criminal justice system is imperfect.
I would say humans are imperfect, except George Clooney. Now there is a perfect human in my
There's opinion. Always anyway, an I'll, exception that proves the rule.
I'll leave you with that. All right, thanks again, Leah.
Great thanks, Darrell. Bye.
Okay, bye. As you probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.